Southeastern Baptist Seminary Chapel Service, Thursday, March 17, 1988. Our speaker, Dr. William Clemens, Professor of Christian Education.
Thank you. Thank God, the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, that in his great mercy we have been born again into a life full of hope through Christ rising from the dead. Listen to the Old Testament lesson as it is found in the fifth chapter of Exodus, the first 9 verses. And after this, Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh and said, "These are the words of the Lord, the God of Israel. Let my people go, so that they may keep my pilgrim feast in the wilderness." "Who is this Lord," asked Pharaoh, "that I should obey him and let Israel go? I care nothing for the Lord, and I tell you, I will not let Israel go." They replied, "It has happened that the God of the Hebrews met us. And so let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifice to the Lord our God, or else he will attack us with pestilence or sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, what do you mean by distracting the people from their work? Back to your labors. Your people already outnumber the native Egyptians, yet you would have them stop working." That very day, Pharaoh ordered the people's overseers and their foremen not to supply the people with the straw used in making bricks, as they had done heretofore. "Let them go and collect their own straw, but see that they produce the same tally of bricks as before. On no account reduce it. They are a lazy people, and that is why they are clamoring to go off and offer sacrifice to their God. Keep the men hard at work, and let them attend to that, and take no notice of this pack of lies." Let us continue our worship together as we stand and sing the hymn number 223, "O God, Our Help in Ages Past." Turning to the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you dwell within the revelation I have brought, you are indeed my disciples. You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." But they replied, "We are Abraham's descendants. We have never been in slavery to any person. What do you mean by saying you will become free persons?" "In very truth, I tell you," said Jesus, "that everyone who commits sin is a slave. The slave has no permanent standing in the household, but the son belongs to it forever. If then the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Be seated. This probably, for me, is more of a confessional sharing of my own journey these last few days, weeks, and months, than it is trying to, in a sermonic fashion, tell you what you ought to do. It has been my own struggle, and I offer it simply as a struggle as I attempt to say what has happened to me in my own faith pilgrimage. You will recognize, especially if you have become familiar with the work of Walter Brueggemann, who for me has become very important in these last few months, you'll recognize that the reading the Old Testament lesson this morning is part of a larger Exodus narrative. And this has become, for Brueggemann, a very important place to write over the past decade. In fact, what he has claimed is that this narrative, this Exodus narrative, was the primary text, the primary paradigm, the primary narrative for the faith development of Israel. both as a narrative to be reflected upon and as a liturgical act to be acted out. In another place, he has described his primary thesis as one of saying that the church is always an alternative community within a society that embodies a dominant consciousness or a Pharaoh perception of reality. And so he sees that the primary task that Moses was working with was creating out of a disenfranchised, dispirited group of slaves a new people. A new people with an alternative way of perceiving reality. And so the struggle is just that. A struggle between this dominant consciousness, a dominant perception of reality, as over against an alternative view of reality. In his most recent book, Hope Within History, he continues this argument by saying that faith development never is a kind of even, always upward movement, progression from one lower stage to a higher one, but it is instead, as looked through this biblical paradigm, a difficult, largely inscrutable movement from one stage to another. It's not smooth, it's not always understandable, and its most characteristic is disjunctive, painful, hidden, because disclosure always occurs at the points of disjunction, not in the moments of equilibrium. Now, this view of faith development is not what has been discussed in recent years in Christian education, but it's an important one if we are to understand what has been going on with us in these recent days, weeks, and months. And it gives us three tools for working with our own faith development. The first being the critique of the ideology around us. The second is the public processing of pain. And finally, there is the release of a new social imagination. And I think that somehow or another, our recent events at this school, as we have gone through some of the most wrenching experiences of our lives, may be helped by Brueggemann's analysis. And so the first dimension of faith development, then, is this critique of ideology. By this, he simply means that we have to look at the system, and you have to analyze it, and understand the assumptions which are made by the way the system works. What are the ideas that are behind the system that make the system work? You have to become almost a social analyst as you look at the system. And he says this is exactly what every Hebrew did. For he learned very early in his faith journey that one's faith could not be placed in the system, only in Yahweh. So he says each Israelite in every generation since the Exodus is taught that they have been placed in the presence of a coercive power, the power of Pharaoh, and they said it in the words, "The Egyptians treated us harshly." That's social analysis. And that's where Israel's story, says Brueggemann, and its self-identity began. And they began to know who they were as they looked around and critiqued what was going on around them. In a real sense, that's what each of us has been experiencing in this clash of ideologies recently, this clash of views of reality. We have clashed, we have seen that clash in the denomination taken over by a fundamentalist reality as it has clashed with a perception of reality viewed by those whose reality is aligned with freedom, individual conscience, and opposed to oppression in all forms. And that clash, and I say this confessionally, has been very painful because we've had to stake out our positions consistent with our critique of the reality around us. And many of us, I included, have felt the agonizing pain of having to take sides, when really all I wanted to do was to simply enjoy the supportive Christian fellowship of like-minded followers of the Christ. No one told me, as the Hebrew child learned early from birth, that the primary paradigm of faith development is conflictual, birthed into a system that demands allegiance and loyalty when only that can be given to Yahweh. And so the Hebrew learned, we do not belong to Pharaoh's world. That's an alien world, and one must not be seduced there. And that's the clash that has been going on. And so this is the foundation, the beginning of our faith development, if we let it, to realize, as we have been pushed to choose sides, Pharaoh has treated us harshly. Now, the second step of faith development, says Brueggemann, is the public processing of pain. It's closely related to the first, and the two work in a dialectical tension with each other. And our faith development must have this public processing of pain in order for faith development to take place. It is the social criticism, the exposure of the dominant ideology. It is very important because, you see, it's not enough to critique the system. That only gives insight. As Brueggemann says, insight never liberated anyone. Insight gives power. It never can give power. It can never give authority to make the necessary withdrawal, the move, the delegitimization of the system. Such power and authority to move in the face of imperial definitions of reality come only from the public processing of pain. Brueggemann says this public processing of pain is an intentional and communal act of expressing grievance with what has been heard. And it is really a risky kind of action in an absolute system. Faith-forming story of the Israelites, if we go back to the Bible and use it to gain insight, in this second phase of faith development says simply, we cried out. The people in their suffering cried out. If you think about it a moment, that is a very revolutionary, subversive move when the oppressive system simply doesn't want us to take notice of the pain. They want pain to be private, in isolation, but there no social power is generated. That's why the public processing of pain is absolutely essential. It is a liturgical, a high liturgical event when one protests in a rally, when one meets someone in court, when one categorizes that this is our pain and rises up to demonstrate about it. It is a kind of civil disobedience. I heard recently Gordon Crosby in a sermon describe the day he went to Selma, Alabama, to march across the bridge with Martin Luther King. They had been beaten back. They had been pushed all the way back, and King knew that they would never make it across the bridge if a group of white ministers did not come down and show up for that meeting. And so he sent out the appeal, and Cosby and a number of them flew in that evening. He says, in the church, as King spoke to them about what they were about to do, about to cross that bridge and commit civil disobedience, he said, there are some times when you have to transcend the laws which are unjust and wrong in the name of a higher law. And then he turned to the group and said, that's what we're going to do today as we march across Selma Bridge. You see, there's a lot of civil disobedience in the Bible. The midwives who were told to kill the Hebrew children were exercising civil disobedience when they refused the order of Pharaoh and they spared the firstborn of the Israelite women. And they gave a very poor excuse as they spared them by simply saying, we can't get there to kill these babies because the Israelite women are so much stronger than the Egyptian women and their babies just simply come faster. And we're not there in time to kill them. Well, that was a ridiculous kind of excuse. But it was civil disobedience. And a very large number of biblical characters have spent a substantial part of their lives in civil disobedience and in jail. And so the public outcry of pain is announcement. It's an announcement for all to notice that the slaves no longer would conform to the system, and they would not silently meet the production quotas any longer and just simply go home at night exhausted. Their outcry is an announcement that Israel would no longer bow before the imperial ideology, because the slaves had noticed that the imperial ideology did not square with the reality of the pain in their own lives. And so the cry of pain begins the formation of a counter-community, an alternative community that sees reality in another way. Now, the public processing of pain is so important because it is that which permits and evokes the redescription of the newness. How have we cried out? I will never forget this semester the banners, the yellow ribbons, the candlelight worships, tears painted on faces, hands bound, mouths taped, black armbands, and a litany of Old Testament woes read in the public meetings. And that's what brings us to our third stage of faith development. The dismantling process produces the pain. The pain is a very powerful key that unlocks the new. And then you begin to ask the question, what will you do now? Dorothy Shuley has written and said, suffering makes people cry out. And then they're crying out, they ask the question, why? The why of our pain, the critique of the system, should lead us indeed to new social imaginings, but not just for our school and our churches and our denomination, but also for the social structures in our nation and world. We really need to see what's happening not only at Southeastern, but what's going on in the world of which we are simply a microcosm. A nation where up to 3 million people are homeless on our streets every day. Where one-third of the families out there on the streets are with young children, and the largest group of those young children are under 6 years of age. Where only 22% of those on the streets have any kind of gainful employment. Where 40% of them are veterans who have been taught to kill, but never have been allowed to work out their anger and their frustration. Where the totals are that we need 7.5 million new low-income housing just to stay afloat, at a cost of $300 billion, and the current administration only allows $3 million for low-income housing. For the bottom third of the nation, 80 million people earn only 8% of the nation's income. One-third of the nation, 80 million people, only earn 8% of the nation's income, where in 1988, the best 10%, took home 35% of the nation's income, who owns 67% of everything in the nation, who owns 76% of the real estate, and why Newsweek would bring out as its edition, why we can't wait any longer. Because we're seeing develop in America a permanent underclass, the new slaves, the new homeless, the single parent families. 1961, Arnold Toynbee stood at the occasion of the celebration of the prelude to independence. He stood at Williamsburg and he said to them, America had its revolution, and it broke free. And the question that faces America, and I think it's still the question, is America going to stand with the underclass of the world, where two-thirds of humankind are still living just above the poverty level and many falling below it? Or will America decide to take an alternative course and concentrate all of her efforts on preserving the vested interest of the affluent minority? All you have to do is look at the headlines this morning to find an answer to that. We must not fail to make the larger connection that the tragedy of our situation is that we may not make that connection between the political new right agenda and its fundamentalist expression and the preserving at all costs of our own privileged economic way of life. And American Christianity, the American Church, and Southern Baptists as a part of it are in danger of aligning itself on the wrong side of the issue just to preserve its privileged status in the scheme of things. John McAfee Brown has recently written and said, he said, I am not so concerned. My greatest fear is not that America is in the danger of sliding down the slippery slope of socialism, but that we will slide down another slippery slope, something akin to the friendly face of fascism. And he adds, and since it was the great failure of the German church to wait too long before engaging in significant protest, the great challenge to the American church is to avoid that failure and to speak loudly and clearly at the first telltale signs of national idolatry so that its development can be arrested before it's too late. I think those signs have already appeared, and we've been right in the midst of it. And we must do our own critique of the system. The Egyptians have dealt harshly with us, and then cry out in our pain. And as we process our pain with the poor and the oppressed, can we be liberated from the system that has enslaved us and begin to think in new creative social structures for a world that is simply not put together as God intended it? Allow the chapel ensemble, as they sing the benediction, to give us time to reflect on our own response. This Irish blessing on this day of St. Patrick. Go in peace. to serve and to love.